20, coming at you with episode 3, Strike 3, Level 1's third movie. Have a sick pod for you, tons of awesome stories, super stoked to share it. Real quick, ways to support: go subscribe and review on iTunes, go cop one of the awesome new Mile High 5 hoodies that just dropped, check out the Level 1 website for that, subscribe to the newsletter, follow us on Instagram, and tell your friends about the pod if you enjoy it, because the whole reason we're doing it is to share these stories. We want to get it out there to as many people as possible. If you haven't seen the movie yet, go watch it right now. Tons of awesome skiing, tons of great shenanigans, well worth your time. It'll be free for the rest of the summer until this podcast series ends with episode 20. And last thing, if you have questions for Josh or Friedel that you want to hear answered on the pod, send them in via email to podcast@level1productions.com. Strike three. We're joined by Josh Berman once again. How we doing, Josh?
We doing.
Awesome. And Friedel Cody for the first time in the booth.
In the stew.
Hell yeah.
Welcome, Friedel.
Thanks.
Good to have you join us.
It's very nice to be here, gentlemen.
So last week we got to hear the story from Josh about you buying tapes from him in the Mount Snow lot. Who was Friedel Cody at that time, back in 2002, and what were you doing there?
2002, I was a senior in high school in Stowe, Vermont, where I grew up, and the previous year been invited to a park shoot in Sugarloaf by Jeff Winterton, who was doing a story on upcoming talent from the East Coast, and one was my good friend Ben Gruno, and the other one was Derek Click. Mm. So that's where I met Josh, more in a more official setting, I guess.
Sure. What was your first impression of Berman back then?
I was pretty impressed that he slid that rail, because that was like one of the first nights I had ever met him. Mm. So I was like, word, like, damn, he's like sliding this 40-foot rail.
Karate chopping trees.
Yeah. And I don't know, he was like an older guy, like, you know, I was a high school kid, so he was like doing it, like making movies, and that's what I wanted to do. So, it was like he was like really making movies. Mm-hmm. So, I mean.
So were you angling to try and get involved like ever after that, or like?
Not explicitly like that. I would say it was more, I was making movies myself.
Okay.
I was with a crew, including my brother Emil, Ben Gruno, and snowboarders, Travis Kennedy, Jake Blauvelt. There was this whole crew of skiers based in Vermont.
But, something in the water up there.
Yeah. We had a really good thing going on. So I was filming them throughout high school. I had a company called Craze Productions at the time, which was not a real company, but a high school company.
Craze product at pshifts.net.
Yeah.
I think was the old email.
Damn. That's, you got the elephant memory.
Phone numbers and email addresses from the people that I always had to get in touch with before we had phones and things we could put them in. It's just like, just had to have a couple of these things on lock. And you type them like several hundred times before autofill. And
But Ben Gruno was the major connection. And that's how I met Jeff Winterton. And that's how I met Josh. So
once again, Jeff Winterton was the connecting glue.
Mm. He was the glue. He was like probably 28, 29, maybe 30 even at the time. I don't know how old he was. But he was kind of like such a motivator. And such a, like a, I don't know what you call it, like a wrangler. Mm. Like he brought all these kids, like we were just kids. Like
he was the first cat herder from East Coast. Mm.
And such East Coast pride too. And that's, he was really trying to like show the talent, like put a light on the talent on the East, which is also what Josh was doing at the time as well. But that was like, and he was a mentor to us for sure, 100%. But after like going into this movie that we're talking about, Strike Three, which is filmed 2001-2002, I was a senior in high school. And my brother was like, I don't know, on like the street rail come up or whatever. I ended up dropping out of school this winter. So I basically rallied. I was just like, let's go do everything. Like, so I just rallied with Emil, with Gruno, with like Liam Downey, who was another up and comer in Vermont. Travis, etc., and just filming like all like there was a lot of stuff to do that winter. I don't know, because I think mostly because Winterton was like setting up all these things, we were just like always road tripping around. I was filming for a movie that I made that year called Proof, but it was peripheral and like simultaneously collabing with you, Josh, because that was like. We did a lot of stuff together on the East that year, including like bringing Steele Spence and Peter Olenek to shoot Street.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a big year, one.
Which was a huge deal because that was like, whoa, these are like the pros from the movies. But also that was the first time I had ever seen like people from the quote unquote West Coast come East to do stuff. So that was a big deal.
Totally.
Because otherwise it was just us doing our thing. But anyway, that kind of was where I guess come into the picture more in in that sense. Because it was still peripheral. I wasn't like filming for Level One necessarily. But we did a lot of stuff together.
Part of the crew at that point, though.
Part of the crew for sure.
Yeah.
More than I even realized, I just recently watched the movie again to refresh for this talk. And I'm in the background of probably 30 shots. No joke. I have some serious background shots.
Background props.
As does Winterton, who is like hype man.
Oh, yeah.
If you watch a bunch of the rails with Steele.
Cackling, and, laughing, screaming,
and
hooting, hollering.
Stoking.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just like,
that was amazing.
Yeah. Like being a serious cheerleader squad. So
that's sick.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So
you can see the guy that was a photographer. As soon as he puts down his camera, he's like whiling out on these makes on these rails.
The Winterton cackle, man.
Yeah,
it lives on through those movies for sure.
And then I'm like the kid in baggy pants and shoes or in an orange hat, like filming on the side or in the front of a bunch of those shots. So
there's a make
a
from
Friedel.
Steele Spence's segment that really caught my eye because he claims it so hard, and I would guess probably Winterton sellies with him.
That's
at
Winterton.
The end of,
yeah, the Randolph quad kink.
Yep.
Yeah. That was like the first switch up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really sick.
Progressing session.
I mean, that was a heavy rail at the time.
Good deal.
That's still a heavy rail.
Really?
Yeah. It's this green quad kink rail in the Randolph,
Vermont.
In Randolph, Western. Vermont, at the I-89 rest stop. And it had been a known beast of a rail for a long time. But we went and did it with barely any snow. We had to move snow to the landing and the takeoff and then set up a picnic table drop-in. I think the state police even came by and just didn't even say anything, which was awesome.
I think I had insurance at that point, and I had contacted the state of Vermont because that's pretty much right when I was really intent on getting permission for stuff, because you could never show up and just like bust something out. Everything was a scene. I mean, it still is today, right? But there was no like skate style, like in my mind, missions. And so we were trying to just get permission. I remember doing the same thing for the underpass, overpass rail in Burlington, UVM. But I would
called the state and said, can we show up and
straight up? Wow. Yeah. Said there is this handrail and we're shooting for a film. Can we,
we're a movie crew.
We're a production company. And, I feel like that was what went on there. I'm pretty sure. because I think I remember having to talk to the state police and let them know, and we definitely were allowed to continue.
Yeah. Work.
There were definitely a bunch of those that year and the next couple of years where we did have permission and I had some kind of paperwork or emails on my laptop or something where I had to like bust them out and show cops that would come and try to kick us out. And
I think in general they're just a little more chill about it.
For sure.
I mean, we didn't have permission. You just had insurance, like as a business, which made it look legit more than just kids.
I think that one I had permission though. I'm going to go after this and look at my emails.
State of Vermont?
Yes, I am pretty sure I got in touch with somebody that managed all the rest areas and got permission. I mean, it remains to be seen what info I disclosed to them as far as what we were actually doing. But I was pretty good about hiding some of the finer details. But yeah, I'm going to go back and look at that. But it's funny. I mean, I think Wallace got permission to slide a couple rails this year, work on a couple school campuses. But I'll tell you, like, for the most part, that, like, nobody, we haven't bothered trying to get permission for something in years. It's just like, go do it and then ask for forgiveness.
Right. There's a
better to ask for forgiveness than
permission. Permission.
Yeah.
But yeah, that session, I just wanted to finish the thought, was like, Steele and Emil, my brother Emil, did the first like switch ups that we had seen. That was like a brand new innovation at the time in rail skiing in general.
There's not a lot of park clips that have switch ups. Right,
exactly. So that was like,
and he does it on the end of a quad king.
Those were kind of just being done in the park, and then they were brought to the street. Yeah. but pretty much, and we were freaking out. In Winterton especially. I remember him seeing some kid trying to do one. We were at Sunday River that same year and just doing one on like a little park rail. And he's like, what's going on? Like the progression is all around us. This is crazy.
That's sick.
Yeah.
There's a, well, similar in a couple ways set up in Hibbert's segment. There's a DFD, it's a square rail in a plaza that there's no snow around. And there's a security guard.
We got kicked out of that.
Oh, yeah? Like, right after that?
Right after that. Immediately after. That must have been first or second try.
That's sick.
Ottawa. That was in Ottawa.
Yep.
That was very high profile.
Yeah, it's the middle of the day.
Yeah.
I think it was, like, Ottawa University or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know Crichton ended up going back to that spot a couple times in the following years and getting kicked out every single time. I think there might be a shot maybe in that strike three or forward segment where, yeah, I was with them and the cops rolled up right before we even got to hit it. And it was just like, no go.
Mm.
Anyway.
Damn. Strike. Well, let's talk about Crichton because that was the big thing from Hibbert segment that I wanted to say. Unless there's something else, but.
Yeah, I mean,
strike three is the debut of David Crichton.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely the standout thing in every way. I mean, that was the first year that Dave Crichton really put all his eggs in one basket of working with us and putting together a segment, and I think it really put him on the map globally as far as what was going on in the sport and what he had to offer. And
memorable stuff.
Yeah.
The pipe runs from what was the competition in Whistler?
WSI.
WSI. Stuff of legend.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Those pipes, yeah.
Mm. There are a couple other things that caught my eye, random, but there's a scene where he just won something and he tosses the check into the crowd.
That was the Molson Snow Jam Tour, which again was the summer quarter pipe, like import / slushy ice machine snow they had all over the place. And yeah, he won whatever event that was. I don't know if it was Ottawa or Buffalo or whatever, but I mean, this is him being a rock star. Just get his big cutout check on stage and just tossing it in the crowd.
It gave me a laugh.
Yeah.
What did not give me a laugh was the crash at the end. It made me quite literally like jump out of my seat and gasp where he slides the bridge and falls off. Tell me, who was shooting that?
I shot that. So, I mean, the Aspen Bridge Rail is... I mean, at least at that point, it was a very famous, in my mind, street urban feature, if you want to call it that, suburban mm-hmm. feature. Mm-hmm. And previously, J.P. Eau Claire slid that shooting for Warren Miller and kind of made it a famous spot. And then that footage ended up in a Poor Boys movie and a few other things. But yeah, J.P. put that on the map and made things like that kind of possible, at least in our minds. Like, we can actually try this. And so Derek Finn, whose family had a spot at the Snowmass Club, we were all crashing during X Games. He brought us there, and we figured out there's natural speed, all the stars aligned, and we had a nice little session. And Derek got the rail. I forget who else was with us. Ben Gruno might have been there cheering us on. But yeah, Crichton came in hot and hooked, I don't know, kind of came off and ended up hooking a tip into the chicken wire that was on the side, which basically spun him around and completely off the rail. And he ended up like hitting his knee or his head or something on the underside of the bridge. I mean, it just like whipped him and ripped him off that thing. And then he fell like 20 something feet onto his ass onto like an inch and a half of frozen river and cracked through that. And fortunately landed upright and didn't do any serious damage. I think he tweaked his knee and then he bit through his tongue. But yeah, I mean, that watching that shot to this day, it's like it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
The noise.
Oh my God. It's like, it sounds like a Zoob tube.
Yeah.
Like one of those tubes that kids shake that just go, wah, wah,
yeah,
wah,
it's like,
wah. Yeah, exactly.
And then he has like he has a lot of one-liners, but this is like, he's like, bad crash. Bad crash. But that shot has probably seen more play.
Absolutely. I mean, that was as we discussed in one of these previous podcasts, like right around the time pre-YouTube, where there was this general thirst for, you know, caught on tape kind of content. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely one of those things where all these producers and shows that I had some kind of relationship with that were asking me for content, I'd send that to them and everybody would be like, oh, gotta have that. And just like signing licenses for that thing all day, every day. And
thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Appreciate it, man.
I think you could still sell that now.
Maybe. Definitely floated level one for a year on licensing fees.
Yeah, you could for sure. I remember seeing that clip when we were at some point in the spring on one of the spring trips in the East. I'm just being like, that was like the shot that you had gotten from whatever that trip was to Colorado.
Oh, yeah.
This is crazy. Mm. And you were making the Strike 3 trailer all throughout that year.
Yes.
That was when like you're like, it was like live editing. Like every time we get a new shot, tying in the Randolph Quad King, as soon as that session went down, like went back and dropped those shots into the trailer. There's like this live, like, ooh, like we'll just keep adding shots to the trailer and then drop it when the season's over. But it's like
that, you know what? That was the first year that I had a laptop, because I actually remember the previous year being in Utah for the Olympics and going to an internet cafe in Park City, Utah to check my fucking email.
Wow. Internet cafe.
An internet cafe. Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we were so hyped on this like live edit thing, is because, you know,
you could do it.
No G4 Mac towers to lug around. It's like, oh man, just plug it in.
Not tied down.
Nope. Exciting times.
Do you remember the trailer song for Strike 3?
What was that?
Shame on a roof.
Oh, wait, that wasn't second generation?
I think it was Strike 3.
Yeah.
I have it seared into my memory.
Okay.
So I don't think we go. Wrong.
Shame on a neighbor was Strike 3. That's when like zero fucks were given.
Yeah.
Very clearly.
Different times.
So I wonder what we used for second generation. Man, I was all.
We gotta go back and look now.
Like corrections corner.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't use it for second generation, but
yeah, it gets a little foggy, folks. Yeah. You know? Years come by.
But
did you guys have the name for the movie already then? When you were putting it together on the road?
I think so. I think pretty early on. So for one, Garrett Britton was still doing graphic design stuff for Level One. He was one of our early athletes. And that's probably right around the time when he was shifting gears away from trying to be an athlete and more towards just being a normal citizen in Ottawa. And but anyway, he definitely was the one doing our graphic stuff. And I think if we were working on the teaser, I remember correctly, working on this like moving animated film strip intro, we definitely had the name and certainly the graphic pretty early on. But yeah, 2002 film was Strike 3, and the whole idea going into it was that was the last Level 1 film. That was it. Strike 3 and I was out, and I was going to go to New York or LA and pursue a much more traditional filmmaking career, because that's what kind of kicked off this whole interest in the first place. And yeah, again, just the ski films were just kind of keeping me busy and keeping me attached to the people and the things that I loved. But obviously that didn't work out so well, and here we are today. But that was going to be it, Strike 3.
I think it was also kind of like, well, maybe you were sort of spinning it a little bit going into the next year, because obviously Level 1 didn't go anywhere. But it was like, that's the Strike 3, and like this is like the make or break year, which it kind of was.
Yeah.
It was like, if this doesn't work out or go anywhere, then it's like Strike 3 and we're out. Mm. But if it's like, if it does work,
then we're going forward.
Then it's like, oh.
See you there for the next podcast.
High five, dude. Nice one. yeah. But that is funny, because that's also the when the number thing was going
to. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, at that point.
Which is intentional.
For sure. But Strike 3, I do remember going into it, definitely, that was the end.
I'm sure, because, going into it.
Because that was the first year that I was no longer a student. I just graduated from college, and I was like, all right, I'm going to do one winter just to, like, commit full-time to this, knowing that I don't have to go back to school in the spring and just really have fun with it, and this is just, like, my last hurrah, traveling the world and playing around with my friends. And then it's definitely got to get real after that. But yeah, obviously didn't work out that way.
Well, it got real.
It did get
just
real.
Just not for selling out in New York. But
no. No, definitely not.
2002 was a banger ass year.
Yeah. Well,
like,
tell me about it for real. Enlighten me.
I don't, I'm just like fresh off of watching that movie and being, I was 17 at the time. So you're very like, You're eating that up. You're eating up what's going on, and you're hyped on everything. No jadedness, no saltiness. Mm-hmm. But that was, though. That was, I mean, as documented in this movie, that was the year that Candide did the 540 heard around the world at Super Park.
Okay.
And
let's talk about
all of that kind of shit was going on. And, like, I don't know. It was just like, that was the year that, like, skiing went from like trying out all this stuff to just being like
refining it,
goddamn legit as hell. And like that's why Strike 3 is kind of as lit as it is, because it has all those moments in it and it like really captures that.
I had seen that 5 before because it's legendary, even to someone who was like an infant at the time, essentially. And that seeing it in the context of this movie was way freaking cooler. What was it like being there for that fucking hit live? Like,
it was awesome. So that was Super Park in Mammoth. I don't remember which Super Park it was, but yeah, I was out there with a big crew of people that I was there to shoot. And obviously those gatherings at the time, it was a who's who of everybody in the sport, from your Jamie Pierres, who were, you know, Big Mountain Huckers, and your Chris Collinses,
Matt and Chris Collins.
Yeah, to your Sages and you know, your burgeoning pros like Rory Bushfield and John McMurray on the, you know, flip side. And then your people like Candide, just, you know, hanging with the rest of the mortals. And yeah, and they built this massive hip that you could potentially go over. And I remember Candide warming it up, and it definitely became pretty clear that his intention was to go over the whole thing, and because he would just like take another 20 feet of height up on the in run and go another 5 feet further along the hip landing, and it's like, oh boy, this is gonna happen. And then eventually he sent it, and just perfectly smooth, just straight air tail grab, just right to the landing. And then he kept going. I don't know if he even did a 3. I think he went right into 5s. and he did three of them. And it's interesting, too, because the other film companies that were there, it was TGR, it was Matchstick, it was Poor Boys and myself. And I'd like to think that every one of these film companies had two or three shooters there with their 16mm cameras and their tripods. And it's like, oh, Scott Gaffney from Matchstick, like, he's on the top angle. And, oh, like, Murray Weiss or Steve Winter, like, they're on the side angle. And meanwhile, I'm running around handheld with my VX2000 covering every single one of these angles all by myself. It's like, oh, okay, now I got to run here. Running up to the top so I can get this in-run cut and the back angle. It's like, oh, great. He didn't land that one. He's going to do it again. I'm going to run to the side. I hope he gets it this time. And, like, looking back at that footage, somehow...
The best-case scenario where somebody doesn't land, you're like, yes, you can move angles
now. Yeah, well, it's funny because looking back at all the different angles I got, I was in the best place at the right time for every single one of those, including the one he landed. And
Berman got the best shots of Candide that day. I'm gonna say it.
Thank you, Friedel.
I'm gonna say it. I remember it at the time, and it still stands true now.
It's funny because, I mean, I hate to say it, but I remember thinking the same thing, and I remember the Powder Awards that year. It was like best air. It's like Candide Thovacs, Matchstick Productions, and I remember like thinking, huh? Well, for one, it was in every single movie. Right. Why are they giving this to, like, one film? And I was like, secondly, that shot they just played sucks because you couldn't even see him land it.
Yeah.
Like, my shot, I remember thinking at the time, like, my shots were better. Like, what? It's like, oh, yeah, because nobody really cares about me in level one. I'm just the kid with the video camera. But thank you, Friedel.
Yeah, dude. Well earned, man.
Lots of running around. Yeah. Like, literally, that's what I did. But yeah, kind of speaking to Friedel's comments about just what was going on in this movie, it was so exciting. There was so much to it. These were just crazy times where, and I started to allude to it in Second Generation podcast, but every time you go out, a new trick is being landed. Mm. Somebody's going bigger than anybody's ever gone before. Somebody's doing a switch up for the first time ever. It was all these amazing moments, and it continued for a couple more years after that where every time you're out shooting, something happens that's straight up never been done before. And, I mean, it's a time that just, you know, you can't keep that going on forever. It's like, yeah, even in 2019, it's like, ah, nobody's done this trick onto this rail. Or nobody's ever just done this with, like, a little tail press here, just a little extra flavor. But I mean, straight up at that time, it was like, oh, yep, there's Tanner. He's doing a switch four onto a park rail at Snow Summit. That's never been done before. Holy shit.
Yeah. There was something more, though, because that the whole, like, everything is new thing probably goes for most better part of a decade there from, like, late 90s.
Sure.
But the years 2002, 2003, like, we can get into it with Ford and stuff, but those also marked something, a shift where it was less, like, there was like this introduction to style into some of that stuff more than there had been.
Well, there was repetition. It was people figuring out, like, they also knew how to do these tricks, and it was like, well, how can I do this trick better or different than the next guy, and rather than just survive it?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the movie, like, you have Crichton, who brought in this, like, very nice finesse to what he did that was not, like, the previous era of just, like, sending and hucking. And then you have Mikkel, who has a brief cameo in this movie as well, doing, like, stuff that was, like, that would still stand today as, like, being real clean and nasty looking.
Absolutely.
And then you have Candide, who was just sending it and kind of just being doing with style as well. But those two guys, I would credit Crichton and Mikkel, especially as this movie goes in turn, like, that was where there was a shift, especially even from, like, Second Generation or whatever. That was like, well, we were picking up on, I mean, I was a fan watching this movie, and all my friends were, so as much as I saw a lot of it firsthand or peripherally, that was like what we were feeding off, was that I think that ushered in the new era, the next era of skiing. But yes, it was still fresh as hell. Everything was fresh as hell. But there was more. There was more. There was more style for sure.
Exciting times.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of fresh, the first two movies, all of the summer stuff, as I understand, is at Whistler. There's a good bit of Timberline hood stuff in this movie. What drove the shift there, and what was the scene like at Hood compared to Whistler way back then?
Well, for me, I mean, Whistler was what we knew early on, and Whistler was where everybody was going. That was the hot spot in 2000 and 2001. I don't even remember anybody in our crew even suggesting going to Hood at that point. I think Hood was really popularized by snowboarding in the late 90s, Wendell's Camp, and it was just like some place that people weren't going, but things were starting to shift in that direction. And that summer, I think did we go to Whistler as well, or just...
Yeah. Yeah. So I drove out to Hood in June with Travis, my buddy Travis, and then we stayed in Hood for a couple weeks, crashing at a buddy's spot and hiking up the park every day.
As did I when I joined. No lift tickets.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we drove up to Whistler where we got a condo for 10 days.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So you would have been rolling with like Derek Finn or something?
Yeah, that's exactly who I was rolling with.
Yeah. Yep. And then we had a condo of like 12 people or something in Whistler.
Oh, okay. No, I remember all that stuff well. That connects the dots for sure. But
must have been nicer than the basement you were staying in Hood.
Yeah.
There's a shout out to the basement in the credits.
Yeah.
There is. I thought I had a spot to stay at the Vocal House, and I remember showing up, and it's like all these racer dudes, and they're like techs, and I'm just like, hey, Vocal sponsors my movie, so-and-so said to come here, and they're just like, nope, no such thing. And so, I mean, I was straight up homeless, and I didn't, know enough other people, and I certainly didn't have any resources to go rent a place or something on my own, and... I guess that's when I probably hit up you and Travis Kennedy and ended up sleeping in this basement where they just had a big party and the whole basement smelled like piss. I remember just like going to sleep on this like mattress in my sleeping bag and thinking like, it smells so bad in here. Like it hurts my head.
But that house was extremely sus.
Yeah.
It was disgusting.
Yeah.
We stayed there for many weeks. It was really bad.
But you weren't in the basement, at least.
No.
Maybe a step above sleeping in the woods.
Maybe. Not necessarily. Like, if I'd had a tent with me, I would have been in the woods.
Yeah.
Easy. But that didn't happen. But anyway, Whistler. Yeah.
Had a condo.
Yeah, right? Whistler was straight up awesome. Yeah. As it always was, especially at that point. And we had a great crew.
It's an insane crew. I remember like getting the place. It was like before Airbnb, but it was a vacation rental, and it was a kind of nice, but also like we filled it with 12 people, so we split it up like crazy. And then we rolled up. We're all like barely drinking age in Canada, but we all roll up, go to the liquor store, come back to this house. And the guy, like one of the neighbors who's probably an owner at this condo complex, was like, I remember getting out of the back of a car, and there was like, this was like 8 people getting out of a car with like handles of liquor. And he's like, I see what's going on here. He's like, there's a lot of momentum going. There's a lot of momentum here, and it needs to shut down a little bit. He's like, I know exactly where this leads, and this is not good. Like, you understand that, boys? Like, I live here, and you're not just going to be drinking handles of liquor like we probably are like little kids. Like,
oh, straight up. I mean, you look at the Strike 3, I'm going to skip around a little bit, was the first year that we did a DVD. I mean, that was a big shift.
Yes.
And with DVDs came hidden features and bonus features and all the things that you really could not pack onto a VHS tape. And I was going through some of the hidden features. A couple days ago, and there is just some priceless old content from that condo in Whistler.
Bad.
Of Friedel's brother Emil just passed out cold, and we're just covering his face with shaving cream and whipped cream and shampoo and toothpaste and all the things, and I think somebody had the foresight to put a black plastic garbage bag under his head so it didn't get all over the bed. And Friedel's just in the background, kind of like posing, claiming, like flashing like gang signs. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. It was some times. There was a lot of those nights throughout that season, I feel like.
And then you have to wrestle him into the shower.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one. And he's mumbling. We actually, like, ran a contest, apparently, according to this bonus feature, that was, like, send a transcript of what Emil is saying. Because he's just, like, mumbling all kinds of shit. Like, get behind me! Get behind me!
Oh, yeah.
It's my birthday! Like, just, like, barely intelligible stuff, but it was like, send a transcript of what Emil Cody says to info@level1productions.com for a chance to win a pair of vocal skis. And I remember actually getting people sending in emails with some sort of transcript. Oh, the best of times. The best of times.
We were kids. Literally kids.
I actually remember being on a patio that night in Whistler Village, and Emil was just all kinds of lit up, and he was trying to climb, it was the Brasserie, and he's trying to climb.
Yeah, in Amsterdam or one of those places.
I think it was the Brass. Yeah. He was trying to climb over this stone wall and grabs the umbrella stand that's in the center of this round table to pull himself up. He starts to pull this whole table with all the condiments off, like, oh, there's like, oh boy. And then he's just like, we pulled him around the back, and he had puked on himself, and his shorts had fallen down, and he's just, like, an absolute mess. And I actually remember somebody called the paramedics, and an ambulance came. Yeah. And I remember I had to accept responsibility and, like, talk the ambulance people, paramedics, like, into leaving. And then we got a cab. And I remember the cab driver pulled up, and we, like, push Emil, like, covered in puke, into the back of the cab. Cab driver's like, no fucking way. Starts to drive away, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Friedel's like pushing the Emil into the cab, and I'm trying to get in the front seat and pull out like a couple $20 bills.
Well, he was like, if he pukes, you have to pay me like $300.
Yeah, but I remember he was like trying to drive away, and I remember just going into my wallet and just like giving him cash and just being like, come on, like, we need to get him home.
It was a situation that had to be mended. He could not be in the village anymore.
No.
Or he's going to go to a drunk tank.
Yep.
Really bad.
And despite all of that, still has a fire segment in the movie.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
I believe switch onto an urban rail.
That was the first.
Yeah. Mm.
I think that was never been done.
That was sick.
Yeah, that was at Champlain College. That old rail at Champlain College in Burlington. I remember that night very well because we had to make that, in classic East Coast style, we had to make that jump out of like what I call rock candy snow, which is snow that was probably powder at one point, got rained on, and then froze sub-zero temperatures. So it's like completely sugary, but like the snowbanks are rock chunks, like ice chunks.
Mm.
And you have to sort of form them into a jump, like pickaxe them, form them into a jump, pour water on it so it sort of stays together and refreezes. That was one of those jumps.
Yikes.
You don't see it in the shot, but man, I remember building that setup. It was not ideal.
Lots of that going on. I mean, that was also probably right around the same time that we did the big like East Coast freeze feature where we got Peter Lennick and Steel Spence out, and we went to Ottawa, and it was the same kind of thing. There's not a lot of snow, if any, and it was just like
kind of later in the year, it like, yeah, sort of melted.
Yeah. I remember looking at a shot of Derek Finn and having a pretty vivid memory of just like digging ice chunks out of a snowbank in a parking lot, stacking them up into some sort of jump form, and then crushing other ones for an in run. It was just like miserable, absolutely miserable, just to like slide around. And then there's no snow anywhere around, and it's just kind of like glare ice, and like your lights are reflecting off of the ice around you. When somebody falls, it's just like this horrible like clash, clang, crunch noise. Ugh, god yeah. Damn.
Struggle is somewhat real.
It was pretty real at the time.
Yeah.
Another standout from Emil's segment was where he smashes a window after greasing the rail.
Yeah.
Where was that?
That actually was in the credits. That was at Sugarbush on New Year's Eve that year. We got a condo at Sugarbush because there was like a bunch of people riding for the mountain that year. Sugarbush was trying to, I think Roy Tuscany was one of the people behind that.
Supporting delinquency. Pretty much.
Pretty much.
Here you go, a whole bunch of underage kids. We're going to give you a condo to hang out for
Christmas week or whatever. Yeah,
which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
That's so a big hookup.
We were all there. It was a big hookup. We were all there. Garrett came down and...
Max Gujai was there.
Yeah. And that... And I'm trying... Casey Rye.
Yep.
Yeah, because we shot a Night Hip that year.
That's right.
That shoot. That it was actually like a Sugarbush sanctioned shoot.
Mm. Yeah.
It was just they pushed up a little mini hip, and I remember Casey and Garrett hitting that thing.
Yep.
But we were shooting like whatever resort rails they had going into the parking lots, because that's like where Gruno does that... wooden
rail
down rail at night,
doing some early follow cams, both you and I actually.
Yep. And then skiing downstairs.
Yep.
But then that rail and mule hit that little dub kink, I think. Is
yep.
it mm-hmm. was
yep.
that was
wrapped in Christmas lights and...
Yeah, it was in a condo complex, I think, near ours, and he hit the wall hard, and it like the or maybe his pole flicked the window.
One
that's what it
two.
Looks like to me.
I think his pole flicked it, because I don't think it was the actual, like... He didn't actually hit the window, but I think it was a pole flick. And we were like,
shit.
Fucking eh. And we...
Did you tell them?
Yeah, we had to, because we were there as guests of the resort. So, the condo was empty. There was no one in there. Mm. But we, like, were sort of like, ugh. We just left and went back. And we're like, that's bad. That's bad, and that's not good.
I remember being particularly freaked out about paying for that. I mean, that was, again, this is the first year that I'm out of college, the first year that I'm not paying rent anywhere just because I'm couch surfing and staying with my parents, but I was actually becoming stressed about how can I pay for stuff doing this? Mm. And that was a big one. And it's interesting because I noticed a bunch of shots from Sunday River had a shoot with Free Skier Magazine that year.
Big shoot.
Pet Fujas, bunch of people came out for it.
Yep.
But I ended up leaving my battery charger in the condo and my little Sony battery charger. And like a couple days later, like called up and they couldn't find it and it's gone. And it was like $120 to get a new one from B&H. And I had like $123 in my bank account. And I'm just like, holy shit. Like, this is it. Like, this is like, I can buy this charger and that's all I can do. And, I mean, that was for me, like a pretty pivotal, impressionable moment where it was like, oh my God, like, what am I going to do? And I don't remember like what I actually did. I probably got a check from a sponsor like within a couple weeks and it took all the pressure off. But I mean, that was really a turning point, trying to figure out how to make this into a business, or if I could.
Mm.
And I remember being terrified.
Yeah.
I feel you.
You're already trying to get by, and then you have some extra... some bonus fees.
Mm. Yeah. Broken windows.
Yeah.
And
I don't even know who paid for that. I feel like...
The marketing department probably did.
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big sure shout outs. The guy's name was Andrew.
Andy LaFrenz.
And yeah.
Andrew LaFrenz. Andy LaFrenz. Yep.
Such a good dude. But yeah, he was just like straight up like, oh, you guys are idiots, but here we go. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, looking back at it now, it's like, you know, if it was a grand, like, yeah, it's super harmless. But at the time, I was pretty gripped.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then you went and spent $2,000 on the limo for Emil's intro that never got hit?
That never really got hit. So it's interesting. Right, I'd say maybe even a year prior, I was trying to think of like what you could do when we're starting to get in a street. What if we had our own rails that we could move around? I mean, that one's great, right? So what if we like put a rail in a pickup truck? What if we put a rail on a pickup truck? I was like, man, what if we put a rail on a limousine? That would give us like the longest rail possible. And within like a month or two of me coming up with this idea, all of a sudden it's like Smith Optics, like limo rail. I'm like, God damn it. Like, come on, guys. And so they obviously got that off the ground before I did and made a really big deal out of it and did good things with it. But, you know, I just started to get the ball rolling on my idea on how to execute that. And so I hit up Freeze Magazine. They were my media magazine partner sponsor at the time. And I think I told them, like, yeah, like, it's probably going to cost like $1,000. And, you know, I just remember being super nervous. And they were like, sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. $1,000 for, yeah. Okay. Which is funny because I probably could have gone to them and be like, yeah, it's going to be $5,000. They'd be like, okay, cool. But we had this super tight budget, and I remember finding this 84 Cadillac super stretch limo. It's either in like Rhode Island or Massachusetts on the internet somewhere. It's like, it's either $500, I think $900 is what it says. I mean, it was definitely under $1,000. And Peter Lennick and I drove out to go get this thing. And it barely ran. It was leaking exhaust into the cabin and just like basically a death trap. And I had Peter drive it back, and I followed him to make sure he survived. And, yeah, then we had the folks at Stratton. I mean, I was pretty tight with them at that point. So they volunteered to build the rail on top in exchange for some logo placement. But the whole idea was to have a chute on this rail. And I think, furthermore, it was to try to incorporate the limo rail into a intro or segment opener, something for Emil, just because he was a rail guy. Actually, I'm pretty sure that his segment that year would have been the first all-street segment ever.
Yeah.
In a ski movie.
Yeah.
And I think in my mind that was to try to promote and or celebrate that accomplishment, because that was actually a thing. Nobody had ever done that before. And so long story short, Emil ended up breaking his wrist, and so he was out of commission. And by the time this thing actually got done... I remember
it was August.
It was August. We took it.
It was not winter.
No, it definitely was not. Yeah, it took forever. But
September, maybe?
Maybe even like early September.
Yeah, it could have been.
But I think I'd gotten permission to shoot it on the RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute campus, because Neil Satyricopoulos was a student there and knew some people. Then I rented a U-Haul truck. And we brought snow down from the Molson Snow Jam in Saratoga Springs, New York. Wow. Filled this thing up, and it was like a 95-degree day. And I remember I had somebody else driving the U-Haul, and I'm following in my Jeep, just looking at just like gallons of water just like streaming out of the back of this thing on the highway. And just
You drove snow across New York State.
We did, yeah.
From Buffalo.
No, from Saratoga Springs.
Which that's only an hour away.
It's still like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. But I remember it was, for one, like we put so much snow in this U-Haul that the suspension was pretty much bottomed out. But secondly, just watching it all melt, it's like, man, we're going to get there. We're going to open this thing up and it's going to be empty. But fortunately, it was not empty. And we had just enough snow to set up an in-run and set up a jump. And that evening, we got the ball rolling. I think it was Paul Cotter that was there with a few other people. I want to say, is that right?
Could have been. It totally could have been.
I think so.
What was he doing there?
Maybe he was at Molson Snow Jam or something. But Paul, if it was not you, I'm sorry. If it was you, then I'm still upset. But
Paul Cotter, though, I just have to go on a little mini tangent here. Micah Abrams did a trivia for the JP Memorialist here in Whistler, and there was a question. It's like, who does the backflip onto the rail in the beginning of Poor Boys Propaganda? And I was pulling my freaking hair out. Who is this man? It was a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
And it was Paul Cotter.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, he blew minds that year.
Oh, he definitely did. And I remember we're mixing up podcasts here, but I know the story from Johnny DeCesare. They were at, I think it was Super Park, and I think they were talking about somebody doing like a flip onto this rail, and Johnny was like, man, if you do it, I'll put you in the intro to the movie.
Very first shot.
Yep. And then Paul Cotter goes and laces his thing, and Johnny's like, all right, cool. There you go. First shot opening the movie. Man of his word, Johnny DeCesare. Yep.
Staying true to that.
Yep. But I think it was Paul. Again, apologies if I got the wrong name here. But the cops or campus security came out, and I had permission, and I'm on my way down to talk to these people. I think Paul and whoever else had speed checked it, and a session was just about to get going. by the time I made it down to like interject and explain what was going on, Paul or somebody else, not Paul, had mouthed off so badly to these security people that they were just like, I don't fucking care what permission you have. You are out of here. And they shut the whole thing down. And this was like the last, like, Custer's last stand. And that was it. Like,
the limo that never was.
The limo that never was. And then the limo
cool rap.
Got parked on my buddy Tony Lamont's property in Bennington, Vermont, or his, like, baby mama's property, I think, and is probably still there to this day next to a whole bunch of other cars.
Got some good scrap metal value.
Probably up on cinder blocks and with weeds growing through the wheel wells and stuff like that. But
I bet she runs.
I bet she runs.
There's a flip onto a rail in this movie. John McMurray.
There is.
Flip on and flip off of a rail in the same segment, which blew my mind.
Stuntman John McMurray opening the floodgates pretty early on. He was he was a loose cannon and certainly went on to parlay that into his group that he was cruising with for a few years. They called themselves the Loose Cannon Players very proudly. And man, McMurray was a very singular individual. Certainly a personality and a talent and just great all-around person. And I spent a lot of time with that crew that year. I'm trying to remember how I first linked up with them, but it was Chris Biolo, Rory Bushfield, John McMurray, these three kids from interior, like, Canada, Saskatchewan, Alberta. And they'd all previously been mogul skiers and were just kind of, like, pushing into the scene. And I don't, again, recall when and where I first linked up, but spent a lot of time with those guys. And
Bushy has Ender.
Bushy does have the Ender.
There's like this big wave of Canadian
influence that absolutely.
Or like, yeah, those kids.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think part of what dictated who I shot with at that point was whose couch could I crash on and who could give me a ride places, because that was currency. I mean, that's what I needed to get around and to make a movie. And it's like, that's how I made friends. That's how I linked up with people. And those are the people that ended up in the movie. And certainly in the case of those three guys, I mean, that was certainly how it worked out. And, I mean, John McMurray, rest in peace. He passed away about 6 months ago, 8 months ago, something like that. Yeah, really, really sad. But, I mean, he went out certainly pushing himself, and I think that he wouldn't have had it any other way. But it's funny looking back at the kind of stuff that we were doing. Like, those guys were very much influenced by Jackass and the kinds of stuff that was going on. And, like, again, these, like, caught-on-tape kind of moments. But
like McMurray, the gainer off the roof.
Yeah, but the difference was that McMurray, Biolo, and Bushy, like, actually had some crazy skill in air awareness. And they had this thing where they were super keen on climbing onto people's roofs in the middle of the day in, like, suburban towns and jumping off into bushes and hedges and trees and just...
They had, like, a good hedge tranny to land into.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so it was... I believe it was Chris Biolo's blue Dodge sedan that the four of us packed into. We had to duct tape four ski bags to the roof of this thing. You could see this vehicle coming from miles away in every direction. I mean, probably hear it too. And we were on our way to Powder Magazine Super Park and passing through Carson City, Nevada. And we're driving through and they see this little suburban draw and they're just like, man, bet there's some great bushes, great roofs in that town. So we pull over and it's like 2 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. And these guys were just driving down the street through suburbia and they're scoping houses where they can see easy ways to climb up on people's roofs with bushes to jump into. And it's like, oh man, like I kind of back this because I'm here and I'm part of it, but I don't know, really. And so this went on for a couple of hours. And I mean, in most cases, people aren't home because it's the middle of the day. But once in a while, you've got like an elderly couple in their living room and they hear on the roof and like cranky old men come like running out like, "What are you doing on the roof of my house, son?" And
understandably.
Yeah. Like definitely I'd be a little disconcerted if that was going on. And like, "Oh, our Frisbee, it's on the roof. Sorry, had to get the Frisbee." And then you got like McMurray just launching huge gainers to like bush tranny like off the side. We're talking like crazy like circus stunts. And yeah, I remember at one point feeling like the heat was on, like people were definitely calling the cops on us, and we're on a side street. We actually see cops drive by like a couple blocks away, just like, "All right, definitely time to go." And so we get back in this Dodge and head out of town. And we're like no more than a mile outside of the town, and they're all like, "Oh man, that was crazy. Like, oh, we gotta chill out. We gotta like definitely pull out the pipe and smoke a bunch of weed." And like, maybe wait until we get a little further out of town. But they would not have anything to do with my suggestion. So of course, within like 2 minutes, the car's hotboxed. Within 3 minutes, there's siren and lights of a cop car coming up behind us. And it's just like, oh my God, we are all going to jail.
In Nevada
in 2002, where different times. But so the cops pull us over and they immediately pull McMurray, who I think was driving, out of the car and just like pull him back there. And we're all I'm sorry. Biolo. They pulled Biolo out of the car. McMurray's riding shotgun and Biolo's back there for like 5 minutes just getting grilled. And McMurray has a bag of weed and he's just like, what do I do? And I don't know if it was his suggestion or Bushy's suggestion, but McMurray ends up eating this big bag of weed. Like a couple minutes later, they bring Biolo back up and they don't even, you know, give us 10 seconds to figure out what's going on before they pull McMurray out of the car and then drag him back. So Biolo starts crying. It's like, I told him everything. I don't know what to do. And 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, 2 years later, it felt like cops come back up and put McMurray in the car. They pull me out of the car and they say, "So you haven't been smoking?" I'm like, "No, officer, I have not been smoking." Like, "Get in the car, get these boys to where they need to go, and do not come back to Carson City, Nevada." It's like, hallelujah. So we continued on to Super Park. The deal was that both McMurray and Biolo had told the exact same story, cop to every single thing that they had done that day, legal and otherwise, including McMurray admitting the fact that he'd ate a huge bag of weed. The cops were so impressed by the fact that they very clearly told the truth about everything that they decided to let us go.
Damn.
Yeah, I think they were super apologetic. They were obviously like, it's the last thing these cops thought was that these kids were going to be super honest about everything.
And
they
probably were, like, really nice.
Yeah. Canadians, eh?
Yeah. They're just like, really?
"We're so sorry we jumped off those bushes." But yeah, I mean, that certainly goes down as like one of my all-time favorite stories about those guys, both encapsulating like how crazy they were and just how nice they were and honest they were as people. And yeah, pretty crazy to reflect. And
that's nutty.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Oh my God.
And then we went to Super Park, and then everything that you saw throughout the rest of the movie went down that happened at Super Park. Actually, a thing I wanted to mention that I saw in your notes about the crash segment.
Yeah.
About
someone getting decked.
The hip of the Candide was warming up. Roy Bushfield broke his back warming up the hip, doing the exact same thing that Candide, or trying to do the exact same thing that Candide was. And Bushy was right at the cusp of where he was going to start redirecting to straight instead of the hip landing. And he came up I mean, he might have even been fine and hit the actual landing if he'd gone straight over. But however he landed, the compression on the hip, just right on the corner, broke something in his back.
Yeah, that was a lot of compression.
Like 40 feet out of the sky.
Yeah.
A lot of compression is right.
Yeah.
It was like straight, like he goes any further and it would be in either of the two trannies. And it's like, ugh. Tough.
That crash section is classic. It just comes out of left field, like whatever that song is. It's just like,
spin the kit. Spin the kit. Oh my God. Yeah. Because
the movie is like mostly hip hop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's mostly.
Yeah, it's not the same metal mix that the first two were, especially. No. And then it's. And then like, it is all of a sudden.
At the time. Well,
shifting gears from punk to hip hop. Because again, I think that's. That's where I had close enough relationships with the athletes that, you know, I was inviting them a little more to be suggesting songs that they wanted to ski to. And I felt a little better about putting the music that I was listening to in the movies rather than just following the trends of what I thought I had to do. And, hip hop was my jam back then. And, that's why we see a lot of it.
Mm. Switching gears back to one of the athlete segments I wanted to ask more about. Derek Finn's come up a couple of times. There's a down, flat, down in Boulder that he gets real angry on. And I thought, it stuck out to me because it's one of the first times I saw like someone's multiple attempts on a rail and kind of showing the battle of,
sure,
of a feature. And also you're giving him like a ton of shit. And it's pretty funny.
Absolutely. So Derek Finn was friends of friends who were going to school in Boulder. He was an aspiring pro skier at the time. I think I actually met him the year before at X Games qualifiers out in Squaw Valley. I think it was the year before, so it was 2001. And I remember he had offered me a ride, and it was like, oh, yeah, like you're going to Aspen for X Games? Like, I'll take you to X Games. I've got room in my Jeep, and... he and I became very quick friends, and I also love to push his buttons.
You guys were like brothers.
We were in so many ways.
Just like always at each other's throats.
But in the best way possible. Like, yeah. I love Derek. I guess I probably kind of treated him like a little brother.
Definitely.
But we
spent most of that season together.
We did. I mean, I think he might have been taking the winter off from school, or maybe he just graduated or something like that. But he definitely had a credit card to put gas in his tank and Jeep Grand Cherokee to cruise around in. I think it was purple. And I actually remember thinking pretty early on he had really good style. He had like a Cork 5. And a 7 that I was super impressed by. And he was, you know, just kind of fit in with what we were doing. And I really liked hanging out with him. And and so that's what got people on our crew and in the movies. And he's also just like absolutely hysterical. And there are more ridiculous stories that I could tell that will just blow your mind. But,
the Derek Finn podcast.
Derek Finn podcast.
Coming next month.
Absolutely. But I actually wanted to tell this one before when we were talking about the rail in Aspen. And so we're all posted up in Derek's family's place at the Snowmass Club, which is this like super ritzy like timeshare place in Snowmass, Colorado. And Junior Martinez and a bunch of the other like homies from way back in the day just like partying real hard, real loud there. And this woman who is like the front desk manager comes up and just like knocks on the door, bangs on the door, whatever, like, you know, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, something like that. And she, from what I remember, and there's video footage of this somewhere, probably like in her late 40s or early 50s or something like that. And this blonde woman, and Derek starts talking to her, and she's like really upset because the homeowners are pissed and like we're partying with kids. And he like pulls her into the bedroom in this place. He's like 18, 19 years old, something like that, and ends up sleeping with this woman. And that's what put out the fire and got us out of trouble. Swear to God. And
what?
Yes.
Total power move. Yeah.
Terry Finn took one for the team. And I'm trying to remember the exact details of what transpired after that, but I feel like at like 5 in the morning, her either husband or boyfriend or somebody is like basically trying to break the fucking door down to like get into our...
To Derek's parents' condo?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it was bad, but it was really funny.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking one for the team, Derek. Appreciate it.
Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah, nicely done.
That was a particularly brutal crash segment, though. Holy shit.
Yeah. A lot of street rails gone sour.
And a lot.
And a lot of super park hits.
That and a lot of pipe.
Oh, pipe.
That was really when people figured out, like, oh, wait a second. Like, we can actually boost out of pipes. And pipes were starting to be made much better. I mean, if you, like, plotted these things on a chart, the development of a half pipe between,
like, the feature itself, absolutely, you're saying.
Between 2000 and 2002, you're looking at these basically like excavator and hand dug built like
dirt ditches
in 2000 to like proper at least 18 foot super pipes, I think, in
super proper. That was near the Olympics.
Yeah.
Like there is,
but I think they're 18 feet.
It wasn't super pipes, but they were like proper zog cut half pipes. But a lot of quarter pipes too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of quarter pipes. Like somebody's going like incredibly high. I forget where it was. It might have been super park. Going like
Hibbert.
Was it Hibbert?
Hibbert does the alley-oop 9.
My goodness.
Yes.
He's going hit.
Oh, yes.
He went like 30 feet out. It's a huge exaggeration, but very, very high. He might have gone close. Like
pretty close, so man. It's nutty. Pretty close. I remember he lined that thing up, and if I remember correctly, he hit it 2 or 3 times and just goes for this alley-oop 9 that, like, I mean, yeah, you're going for an alley-oop 9 out of, like, it might have been, like, a 25-foot-tall pipe, quarter pipe, but yeah, like, beautiful setting right up against these rocks, and, of course, it was just, like, stacked with all the crash pads. He went a solid 10 feet higher than anybody else did. Landed like 15 feet deep on the deck, like deeper than all the crash pads, and just like splatted.
That's the perfect word for it.
Yeah. I think at that point it's definitely a splat.
There's a backcountry QP in the intro segment. John Cazzotti goes similarly to the moon, and then
Chad's quarter pipe.
Yeah.
That's actually the landing of Chad's gap in Cottonwood Canyon.
Sick.
And I mean that was in the days before we even like thought of doing something like actually building Chad's Gap. I mean, we're just like starting to dabble.
That was entry level.
Yeah. That was
Utah backcountry trip.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. So for one, I'll point out that we had no idea what we're doing. We had no concept of, you know, south facing versus north facing and landings getting baked and whatever else. We were also pretty much too lazy to hike from the bottom of Little Cotton Canyon. So the alternative at that point was to get tickets from Solitude, go to Solitude, then traverse across from the top of the lift to get ourselves to the top of Grizzly Gulch, and then ski down. And that's how we did it. We might have actually hiked up to Chad's.
So that's the answer, that old new school's joke, how to get to Chad's Gap from the bottom of Alta. You get tickets. It's Solitude, which is in Big Cottonwood Canyon.
You traverse over.
And then you cross canyons over the ridge and then ski down through Grizzly Gulch to Chad's Gap.
That is actually how you get there. That is what we did. And then we had to...
But it's been blown up.
Yeah.
And Mark Frank will be there.
We then had to take a bus down and then another bus up to get our car. So the end of
unreal.
The day...
Unreal. That's like, the most convoluted possible... tour I can
but Friedel up. You're missing it. We didn't have to hike up.
Yeah and it makes for a good experience. Character building.
Oh man, but it's so funny looking back. We're like, oh man, like this, like we can put a jump here, like this would be a cool backdrop. Sweet.
It kind of is a good quarter pipe spot.
I just mean in general, our approach, like, we had no idea, like, what we were actually doing. And looking at some of the jumps we built and the things we did. But, yeah, I mean, for the most part, like, it was a solid quarter pipe spot, except for the tranny getting into was pretty tight.
It was, but Cazotti popped hard. Like, he went really, really big.
Absolutely.
Like, that, if he had stomped, like, if somebody did an alley-oop on that right now that big, that would be...
Absolutely.
I've seen people hit that feature to set the landing up as a QP and go nowhere near that big.
I know. It's boosting, man.
It's Canadians. They're
boosting, zero Fs. Yeah.
That was, incidentally, the year of the Olympics in Salt Lake in Utah, Park City. And we were all posted up in John Turkola's rented house down in Salt Lake City. And we would do all the backcountry stuff during the daytime, and then at night they had something called the Ice Village downtown in Salt Lake where they had a quarter pipe, and then so we'd shift gears and go shoot that,
which is a standout in that movie.
Absolutely. I mean, we had, you know, our crew that we were with during the day, and then we had like Crichton and Tanner Hall. And Matt Sturbins was there trying to set what he thought was going to be the world quarter pipe record at the time. And C.R. Johnson, all these players from back in the day. I mean, that was like, there's obviously no new school free skiing going on at the Olympics, but so many people would just congregate in Utah regardless, that this was this like cool venue hangout thing that we could all just go do.
Yeah, it's like a dirt ice quarter pipe in the middle of the city.
Yep. Yeah.
But that was cool. I remember that from perspective from the day that was, those are really cool shots, especially obviously DC, Switch Sev.
Mm-hmm.
And whatnot. Air to Fakey, trying to think of other stuff. Everything he did, he
sessioned that thing.
He did. Put a clinic down on it, but that was like pretty progressive at the time.
Other stuff from the credits that I really enjoyed. There's a homie who just gets a giant snowball chunk, like, rolled over his gut.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was actually the in-run to Chad's quarter pipe.
Okay.
With the Canadian stunt kids.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, they were just, like, what could they do to just be funny? And
I love that.
I think that was either McMurray or Biola that was just like lying down, like sacrificial lamb style. Like, let's get the biggest snowball we can and just roll it over him. And yeah, I mean, again, those dudes just super entertaining, nonstop laughs and excitement.
Mm.
Always.
Was that them at the end of the credits with the pots and pans?
Nope. Pots and pans.
You gotta help me out with the faces.
That, I believe, was Sugarloaf.
Yep.
Sugarbush, I'm sorry. So that, I believe, was Sugarbush.
Yeah.
During that same trip that we were talking about during the holiday period, where that might have even been New Year's Eve, because
had to have been New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting on the couch in the back wearing like a New Year's Eve hat. So it was New Year's Eve. There's a lot of stuff going on. I was like, whoa, I was there in the room. This is hilarious.
Friedel had the New Year's hat on all week long, but
true.
But no, it was probably to see everybody that lit up was probably New Year's Eve. At least I like to use that as an excuse.
It was.
But Max Kujai and Garrett Britton broke out the pots and pans, and again, I think this is just like combination of influence by Jackass and some of these other things that are going on, like it, and just, you know, the fact that we're all ridiculous. We're all in, like, late teens and early 20s and just, like let's just do stupid stuff. And I definitely was not the instigator. I was just, you know, passively recording behind my video camera. But, I mean, those guys just came up with something where, like, let's just take turns hitting each other in the head with pots and pans.
And then some sort of shovel for the fireplace.
Oh, yep. That was the final one. Just basically, like, his brain cells just kind of like froze up for a second. It's like,
it's so proper looking though.
Oh yeah,
the pan was brutal. Like, that's like, oh boy, it's like, you're not gonna come back from this one. And then the spatula thing was like so proper. Like, Garrett's like, he hits Max super hard, and he's like, oh, that was bad. He's like, get me back. Get the fuck me back.
He's got a cigar in his mouth.
And they're just passing, like, it.
Yep. Yep. Oh, man. I mean, different times. I mean, again, I think that just kind of speaks to the point where we all were certainly not taking this very seriously, and this is just the stuff that we're doing at night and casually recording all of the ridiculousness. And yeah, I think that was probably like the limit of the kind of stuff that we'd actually put in the movie. But there was a lot more ridiculous stuff.
Right. It's the perfect blend of like not the perfect blend of violence and mildness, and it's just like good, clean beating each other up. Like,
yeah, one little one very, for one.
Yeah,
even sided.
Yep.
No victim.
Right. You can feel the love in them beating each other. That's what I love.
Yeah.
I think Garrett ultimately took the heaviest hit from that little fire poker shovel, ash shovel
he
thing.
Did get Max pretty nice with a pan though. To the point where it's like, oh my gosh, dude. Yeah.
Like you can see he Brain feels him. Bad in Brain his him. Eyes as he's doing it. Yeah. It's so great.
He's too nice, but he also has to, he knows he has to participate as an equal participant. So, yeah.
Good, clean fun with pots and pans.
Yeah.
Timeless
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It stands today. It's future-proof stuff. It's very entertaining to this day.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to watch Strike 3, then just fast forward to the credits and watch the pan fight.
Yeah.
Straight up.
And miss out on a lot of really, really sick skiing. There's a certain thank you to a certain energy drink rep in the credits as well.
Oh man, Red Bull School, that's where we're going. So Red Bull at the time, in their effort to promote all kinds of cool and progressive events, they put something on called Red Bull Schooled, Waterville Valley, New Hampshire. Whole idea for this contest, and it was just too far ahead of its time, was to have a slope style ski contest for college students. And like, man, 2002, you could probably count on one hand the amount of people in the Northeast that were capable of like skiing a legit slopestyle contest. The people that were going to college were definitely not really on that kind of level. So Red Bull had invited me to come hang out and bring along Steele Spence and Peter Lennick, because we were cruising around the Northeast at that time. That was right on the tail end of our trip to Ottawa to shoot a bunch of rails and kind of just like the send-off of that particular trip.
Mm.
And I remember there's a ski condo and a snowboard condo. And we go to check into the ski condo. And our buddy from Red Bull shows up with a couple cases of Red Bull and a couple cases of vodka. Which, if you do the math, doesn't really equal out quite well. And then never mind the fact that I, at age 22 or 23, was the only person of legal drinking age and certainly far and away the oldest person like in a four-condo radius at that point. So I'm like de facto in charge dad of this group of underage college kids and a couple athletes that were just put in this condo for a few days to party and hang out. And I don't know if it was the first night. It was actually, no, it was really the last night when things got out of
hand. It was last night.
I guess after the event. And people started passing out and vodka was flowing like wine. And I actually take responsibility. I remember thinking to myself after we ran out of booze, like, man, you know, these are all privately owned condos. I think that, you know, there's like a locked closet somewhere and probably some booze in it. So I took it upon myself to find this closet, and I think I pointed it out to somebody. I did not do the breaking and entering myself, but I probably suggested it.
You planted the seeds.
I definitely planted the seeds. And so this closet got opened up, and in this closet, it was like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but with booze instead of gold. And I mean, that just like kicked off an obscene night. Cops were called on several occasions. Actually, there's some great shots in one of the hidden features in Strike 3 of a bunch of these kids just getting drawn on with markers and dicks written all over their faces and booze poured all over them. And Derek Finn just getting, was he there too?
Probably.
Probably just getting like covered with talcum powder and antiquing, I think that's what we call it. When somebody passed out, you take a thing of talcum powder, you rip the cover off, and you just blast them with like a handful of talcum powder.
Or flour.
Or flour, yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
you got.
Whatever kind of white powder you got on hand.
At home.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, just a ridiculous night. But the craziest aspect of it all, I remember going across the way to the snowboard condo, which was in another complex. And our friend from Red Bull was staying there. And I remember he was just instigating. Just like, what can we do to turn this whole situation up to 11? I remember walking into a bathroom upstairs where he was trying his damnedest to rip the toilet out of the bathroom floor, which I think he eventually was successful in doing. I remember going back the next morning. Friedel, did you stay there? What was your role? Because I remember you were around.
I was around. I did not have a role in this at all. I was staying in this not snowbird house, but I know that visiting there that they were throwing couches out the upper deck, all the furniture out of the balcony.
I remember
it was bad. I was like, fuck, this is so fucking bad. Like,
I remember feeling
not fucking down. I was like, these are all like college kids, like truly like FSUing, like fucking shit up hard, like full blown, like
wait, just, riot mode.
Yeah.
Well, they were encouraged to do it by the people that were supposedly in charge, and they were just given like unlimited access to booze. And I mean, things just got worse than loose. I remember going the next morning. I actually had to get up super early and take Peter and Steele to either like LaGuardia or JFK Airport. And so we had a big drive ahead of us. And I remember going over for some reason to the snowboard condo and walking into the living room, which was on the second story, and looking out where the sliding glass windows or doors had been, and onto the balcony, and just seeing couch, ottoman, recliners, paintings, fridge, just like you name it, just tossed in a pile, you know, 25 feet below off the back of this deck. And I think I heard that criminal charges were filed and somebody got sued. And
the rumor was that Red Bull had put out like a vendetta on the people that did the damage and were like trying to, which is not true. It was definitely not true, but it was like, or that like people involved had put out like a mafia style, like find these.
Oh, like a hit.
Not it. Yeah. Like a hit, but like, find them and make them pay up, basically, because they did like $10,000 in damage or whatever. Yeah. But it was awful. Like, it was bad. It's like, this is bad. This is like bad juju. Like, people are just being psychos.
Yeah.
It
wasn't
fun or cool at all. Like, nothing about it was cool. I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, why are you guys doing this?
The crazy thing is I'm pretty positive it was the dude from Red Bull who was like setting the whole thing off.
Are you snitching?
The statute of limitations has expired. It is completely cool.
I honestly didn't know really many of those people there. It's not, yeah, it was like, I knew, obviously knew you guys and
I remember Steel. The dude's name. I'm not going to say it though.
that was probably the gnarliest destructive party I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've never been anything like that. I will say the ski condo, all that happened is we stole all the booze and everybody passed out eventually.
Yeah, that condo that we were in, everyone got way too drunk.
Yeah. Too drunk to do any damage.
And I remember somebody had like pushed over the light pole outside. And like when the cops came, they were like, what's up with this light pole? I'm like, ah, so weird. It was totally like that when we got here.
What's really funny though, looking at the shots and that hidden feature, like not only am I the one talking to the cops, but very clearly I am holding my camcorder and videoing the cops while I talk to them.
And they thought it was funny.
Oh, they did.
Because you're like, nothing is happening here. And they're like, we can see that a lot of stuff is happening here. Like, we are not, like, you're not invisible. Like, everything is totally chill. And they're like, no, it's clearly not, because 5 feet away from us, people are just, like, wiling out.
I think passed out at that point. I remember, passed out, yeah. I remember they said something about the beer, and I think simultaneously myself and, like, a few other people behind me all say at once, what beer? Yeah. And the cops straight up chuckle.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, you guys. But, yeah. Whoever's good, in good the times. Condo, man, ugh. The other condo. My goodness. May God have mercy on your souls.
Yeah, this is a good incentive to go watch Strike 3, because it may or may not be in the credits.
It turns out that year had a lot of drinking and debauchery.
Yeah.
More than any other year, for sure, looking back on it. That was a, like, boot camp for... sending it.
Well, I think as all the riders start to get, not even travel budget, but basically if you're sent around to different places, as soon as you start traveling, it's this excitement and incentive to start partying. Because, like, oh, cool, we're in a new place. We're at this event. We're doing this thing. We got these new people with us. Mm-hmm. And, like, all these factors come into play. And, again, we're all, like, late teens, early 20s. So it's like, what do? You party. So it happened.
Well, and it, like, honestly, when you're meeting a lot of new people, is the easiest way to get to know new people is to get really weird.
Yeah.
One last person I want to talk about. Simon DeMont has a quick appearance, not the longest segment, but a segment in this movie. How'd you come to know him? How'd he end up there? And, yeah.
So Simon DeMont from Sunday River, Maine, I think he actually showed up the year before at a spring shoot that we did at Sunday River and logged a couple of random shots that I don't think they even made it anywhere. Maybe in the credits of Second Generation, if anything. But I think that's where I first met Simon. And Rory Will, who was also from Massachusetts but did all his skiing, I think, at Sunday River Gould Academy, he was a big supporter of Simon, proponent of what Simon was doing, and kind of introduced him to myself and Jeff Winterton. And if I remember correctly, I was out in Utah and I was talking to the Red Bull guys about trying to fill some open spots at the Red Bull Huckfest. And somehow Simon's name came up and I helped get him to the Red Bull Huckfest, and his mom just, like, shipped him out, and he's sleeping on the floor at John Turkle's apartment in downtown Salt Lake with me, hanging out, and then going to the Red Bull Huckfest. And then somehow I think he impressed everybody so much there that it's like, oh, does this kid want to go to the X Games too? It's like, sure, Simon, I'll take you to the X Games. Let's go to Aspen after this. And that just kind of got the ball rolling. It's like, oh, well, Simon, I'm going up to Whistler. And Simon's like, cool, I'll go to Whistler too. Let's go to WSI. And I was, I'm not going to say babysitter, but surrogate guardian for Simon for a few months that winter. He was like 14, 15 years old. 14?
I think he was 14.
Really young.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
That's young.
I was thinking 16.
No, because he was 16 when he won X Games 2 years later.
Yep.
But he had a freaking dude.
Oh, yeah.
He was 14. I remember when he rolled up. I think the first time I met him was when we shot the Mount Snow Carinthia deck rail, and he rolled up there with, maybe he had just rolled up by himself from Maine, but he obviously had come with someone, because he couldn't drive at that point.
With a booster seat, maybe.
But he was like, you know, it's Dumont, he's like not a tall guy, and he's like just like this kid, like, and he was still a kid, like he's 14, and he was just like such a... pretty hilarious, actually. Yeah, like a funny little dude. But like so full of just like giving everyone so much shit and just being ridiculous.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand when that comes when you win X Games at 16, but when you...
No, he had
like
confidence.
He had that already.
He had confidence well before that. But I mean, fast forward 2 years from then, I stayed with him in Sunday River that fall when we were filming for High Five, and he was like going to X. He had been invited to X Games Pipe that year, and I remember rolling around in his car, and we had done this big loop around Maine during a snowstorm before Christmas, and he was like the only time I've really spent intimate time with Simon ever. And mm-hmm. he was like, I'm going to win X Games. And he actually, we went through a drive-thru in like a McDonald's, and he was like, he paid for my meal. I was like, you want some cash? He's like, no, I got it, dude. He's like, I'm going to win X Games next week or whenever it was. He's like, and he did. He also told me straight face, he's like, I'm going to be the first skier that makes $1 million. He's like, we need to bring like basketball player money into this sport. And as far as I know, through the course of career, he definitely made $1 million. So, like,
he told me at one point he was making $1 million a year.
So maybe he made him, yeah. So either way, he crossed that goal. Like, but I just remember being like, damn, like, word, that's legit. Like, I mean, and, you know, he believed it and he did it. But I was like, you can't really knock a guy with that sort of confidence and drive.
No.
But yeah.
Especially if they actually get it done.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to speak stuff into existence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no question. He was just like, yeah, I'm going to win X Games when I go out there in next month or whatever. And he did. I remember, yeah, it was legit. But that's ahead. We're getting ahead of ourselves here, chronologically speaking. But
yeah,
that's Dumont pre, fame mm-hmm. or whatever. Yeah.
Well, go watch Strike 3 so you can see pre-fame Dumont doing it up. Getting babysit by Josh.
I kept him out of trouble.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sounds like you probably knew how to find it.
Eventually.
Mm. Sweet. Anything I missed you guys want to talk about?
DL Incognito.
Oh, yeah. So, through Scott Hibbert, we were introduced to DL Incognito, who became a friend of sorts, super talented hip-hop artist out of Ottawa, of all places. Managed by his brother, Nikki Braids, and those guys were super keen on us using a bunch of their content, and I think we used 3 or 4 tracks that first year, maybe?
At least two. Because it's Audio Coke is the track for Crichton's part, and then Hibbert has a DL part.
Yeah. And if it was but only then two, then they're
forward
definitely...
Forward and...
Absolutely. Like, went on for a few years, and DL became kind of like a... You know, a stalwart certainly of our soundtracks, but definitely a little bit of a, you know, name recognition player in ski movie music for a couple of years. And it was a super nice dude.
Yeah. As well. It all accumulated with him playing the premiere for Shanghai 6
in Boulder, Colorado. Sure.
Berman flew him out from Ottawa to play the show.
Like, he opened the movie, basically?
Yeah, he opened the movie. It was awesome.
It was insane.
And he played, like, all his songs that...
At the Fox?
Where? No, it was called the Flatirons Theater, which is now a liquor store on the hill. So it's further up the hill from the Flatirons Theater.
Not very far away from the Fox. It's kind of the twin theater, or whatever. A little more loose, looser operation. But
if by little you mean a lot. But, that's why they're no longer in business. But
DL, man, that was at that time. I feel like Strike 3 brought this underground hip-hop into that movie, like into that soundtrack, especially like somebody like DL, who was a serious talent, like made good tracks that were part of Level One soundtracks for 3 or 4 years. It's because somebody's like buddy worked with him. Wasn't Hibbert's
like
buddy
a Burger King or something?
Yeah, in Ottawa. Shit.
Yeah,
damn.
I think that's the story. It was a Burger King,
but
that's
sick.
Yeah,
big come up.
Audio Coke.
That was a boss.
Part number two. And Crichton has... Steel has opener. Mm-hmm. Crichton has number two.
Yep.
It's part of why I always love the number two placement. You're like warmed up.
You just got to hit him hard.
Yeah, and you hit him hard. It's like that Crichton part in Strike 3 is like always the... That's like my classic second part, holding it down part.
Yeah, on the topic of Audio Coke... I can like actually close my eyes and put myself in the Flatirons Theater during sound check and hear DL just bust into Audio Coke, and just like the little fanboy in me just like freaked out and was like, oh my God, I cannot believe this is happening. And straight up, that was a memorable premiere.
Yeah, it was for sure. Big timer.
Frieda, at the start, you talked about filming this movie during the senior year of high school.
Yeah.
And then not really finishing that senior year of high school.
Right. That's yeah. right.
Yeah. How'd that work out?
Good so far.
Hell yeah.
It's 18 years later.
Yeah.
17 years later.
I really like the odd couple combo of the Dartmouth grad and the high school dropout.
Yeah.
Yin and yang. Works well, though.
That to me was like, well, this is like, there was no decision-making involved in it. It was very much like, this is the path that I'm on right now. This is very exciting. And it's not going to like slow down at any point. So there wasn't any sort of, hemming and hawing. It was like, school's not working out.
We're doing this.
Fuck it. Let's go.
On the road.
And it hasn't really, my life has changed. There's obviously been changes, but like there's a lot of similarities where I can get like deja vu from like that era and things are still somewhat the same, for better or worse. I mean, it's like a little bit of Peter Pan syndrome, but it's let's put it this way, I can still relate to myself from when I was 17. So, because we're still doing similar stuff. It's like not everything evolves, but a lot of the elements of it stay the same. So,
fuck yeah,
that's cool.
Funny you mention that, because I basically grew up building jumps in my backyard to ski on. And I mean, as early as, I think somewhere in my family has either like 8mm film or photos of like a maybe 8-year-old me jumping over my 6-year-old sister in the backyard of our log cabin in southern Vermont. And it's funny, that definitely strikes me once in a while. And again, this year I spent a bunch of time in the backcountry shoveling some jumps, and definitely, yeah, it's crazy to think, like, this is what I've actually been doing for 30-something years, maybe, in one capacity or another. Like, here I am, like, shoveling snow.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice, actually.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah. Thanks, tune in next week to hear about more snow shoveling. Yeah. Because we did a lot of that year, too.
Yes, you did.
Awesome.
And the stories that come with it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Spices. And also, Strike 3 is not the last movie.
Stay tuned for number 4.
Yeah. Stay tuned for number 4.
Thanks for listening. That was episode 3 of Level 20. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you listen to your pods so that you can get future episodes coming straight to you. We'll be dropping them every Sunday. Make sure you go watch Strike 3 if you somehow made it to the whole end of this pod without watching the movie first. Those ways to support: go cop something from a Level 1 store if you want to support independent filmmaking, or save up your pennies for the 20th Level 1 movie coming out this fall, Romance. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you next week. Shame on the nigga who tried to run game on a nigga who